All right, welcome back to Whence Came You, a Freemasonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. I'm your host, Brother Robert Johnson. This is episode 138. So in the news, Virginia passed an edict, and if you didn't hear about it, I invite you to check out the Masonic Roundtable episode 8 to hear a little bit more about it. It's a little bit controversial. Also, last week was an April Fool's, and I think a friend and guest of the Masonic Roundtable got most of us. Brother Tom Acousti posted an article about Lodge corporate sponsorship on his website, The Tao of Masonry. Needless to say, countless brothers fell for this, and I have to say, I almost believed it myself. Thanks to Tom for a really good April Fool's joke. So this week, I wanted to read a few short talk bulletins. The first from October 2013, volume 91, number 10, entitled Masonic Mentoring at its Best. Masonic Mentoring at its Best by Kevin Pentelow. Children are looking for someone to inspire them. Someone who demands more of them than they do of themselves. Someone to show them that their true potential. For me, this person came in the form of a junior high music teacher named Mr. Howard, a tall, slender man with a boyish look except for his Tom Selleck-style mustache. He was different because he was one of the few that cared for the poor students as well as the best. The first time I went into his class, I sat in the back of the room, as I always did, which tells every teacher all they need to know. I was wearing the uniform of the troubled teen, ripped jeans, long black oily hair, and a Kurt Cobain t-shirt. I screamed of the bad boy persona that I was cultivating. I was a troubled teen, much more troubled than most. With my parents divorced, I was living with a struggling single mother. Many responsibilities fell on me to contribute monetarily to the family for rent and other needs. My work schedule as a laborer on the farm and being severely dyslexic made me contemplate dropping out of school. I was on my last chance at school. I already had been kicked out of my last school for fighting. I was failing almost every class. As I look back, I can see the fights and my misbehavior were direct reactions to my learning disability. I was put into a music class, not so much because of my interest, because that it was one of the few classes I had not gotten kicked out of yet. Mr. Howard commented on my leg moving up and down in a nervous manner. Awake from your daydream. You have a good rhythm going with that leg. Want to use that nervous energy to create something? He asked abruptly. I'd rather destroy, I said, having listened to too much punk rock and watching too many 80s action movie villains. Sometimes you must destroy to clear the way and create something new, Mr. Howard replied. Sometimes the desire to create is in your blood. Music is in your blood. There are no words to express the inexpressible, however, in music we can come close. You are indeed in need of a positive outlet, what much as I was at your age. He didn't just kick me out of class. He rationalized with me, and it worked. His words made me think. After a few classes on music history and the little experience with Mozart's The Magic Flute, I was placed in front of the drum set. Mr. Howard's only words were, "Now it is your time. Destroy to your heart's content." I began to play. The class faded away as my pounding percussions came to the forefront. I felt the pressure of the world slide off my back like rain off an umbrella. All of my problems were forgotten, blurred into a distance, hammered out by the pounding, shamanistic rhythm of my drums. For the first time, I knew what freedom was. Freedom from judgments of others. Freedom from the troubles at home. Freedom was a real thing for me for the first time. I pounded away on that drum set, and in the wink of an eye, the whole school day had passed. When the bell rang, it was as if I had awoke from a dream. That was the day I found a passion that I would enjoy the rest of my life. I began to play the drums during all of my study halls. At home, I put together a makeshift drum set out of buckets and PVC pipes. Trash lids, saw blades, old pots and pans were used for cymbals. I played until my hands were chapped and bleeding. I learned to play most of my favorite songs on the radio. I even started my own band with some friends and began playing gigs at local bars. I earned enough to quit my farm job. Mr. Howard showed me that if I applied myself, anything is possible. I started putting the same intensity into my studies and my grades shot up. I was shown how to read music, and while reading all the lyrics from my favorite bands, my reading ability exploded to new heights. Performing the drum solo in The Wipeout at the big end-of-the-year performance gave me the confidence to get over my stage fright. During one of my performances, I saw my mother crying. It was the first time she knew that she wouldn't have to worry about me, that I knew what I wanted to do with my life. I graduated from high school and then from a 4-year university. I continued to play music. I would go on to learn the guitar, the bass, banjo, harp, mandolin, and even the saw. I have played in numerous rock bands. Songs I have written have been recorded and played on radio stations during tours through the East Coast. I always wondered if I would see Mr. Howard again. I had lost track of him and had no way to thank him for all that he had done for me to change my life course. Recently, after receiving my 32nd degree in the Scottish Rite in Syracuse, New York, I was sitting down to eat when I heard my name. Kevin! I looked up to see my former mentor, who, unknown to me, was a Masonic brother, and had been randomly seated at my table. I knew who it was in an instant. He still had that boyish face, I remembered, and the Tom Selleck mustache. As we conversed, he said to call him Steve, but I kept slipping back to Mr. Howard. We talked and caught up on the last 20 years. I told him of the path that I had been on and how he shaped it. I told him I always tried to give something back, whether I am volunteering in the local prisons or giving music lessons to those with developmental disabilities. I am only able to help these individuals because of the help that he gave me all those years ago. Not a day goes by that I don't think of how I might have ended up, and the thought scares me. Every time I walk into a prison, I can't help but think that it could have been me on the other side of those bars. Mr. Howard listened to me uncharacteristically brag for quite some time of my musical and financial accomplishments and my volunteer work. He seemed moved to have been a part of my journey. Then he looked at me sternly and asked me what office I held back up at the North Star Lodge 107. He told me of the great respect he has for the Masonic degrees and the joy he gets from taking part in them. He talked about how, by memorizing the different parts of the degrees, he was able to build what is called a memory palace. Using the description of Solomon's temple given in the Book of Kings, he would subscribe each passage of the ritual with a specific room. These mnemonic strategies also helped him remember co-workers and students' names. In his music career, the strategies helped him memorize long, difficult, tempo-shifting songs. He also told me what a great feeling and great honor it was to be elected the worshipful master of his lodge. I was once again inspired by this man who had already given me such a rich source of inspiration. Since talking with him that day, I have memorized parts of the Masonic ritual and gained a new insight and appreciation for our degree work and our great brotherhood. I have to thank him for that. You do not have to look any farther than your lodge to find a blueprint for greater achievement. An inspirational person might be there. All you have to do is ask him the right questions and learn as much as you can from the older generation of brothers. Soon it will be your turn to be called on to be that inspirational person for others, not only in the lodge, but everywhere you go. All right, I hope you enjoyed that. The next one is from April 2012, Volume 90, Number 4. It is entitled Most Excellent King Solomon. Most Excellent King Solomon by Dr. J.C. Montgomery, Jr. Most Worshipful Brother Montgomery served as Grand Master of the Grand Lodge of Missouri in 1978 and 79. He's a fellow and past master of the Missouri Lodge of Research and former editor of the Royal Archmason International Journal and the Missouri Freemason. Recognized as an outstanding Masonic author, he holds a Doctorate of Divinity degree from Central Methodist College and is a retired United Methodist minister. The Short Talk Bulletin encompasses excerpts from an article originally published in the winter of 2011 issue of the Missouri Freemason. I wonder if you have ever had the experience of sitting through a degree or listening to the same old ritual, and all of a sudden a phrase, a word, even an action caught your attention in a new way. Now, I don't know how many third degrees I have witnessed or taken part of in my 71 years as a Master Mason, probably a good many. But it was the second section, the lodge had become the theater. In the first act, brave and steadfast Hiram had gone dark. In the second act, the scene is a lodge room with the nearly finished Jerusalem temple. The officers have taken their stations, King Solomon, and he addresses the senior warden, and that officer responds, "Most excellent King Solomon." That moment jarred me. Ordinarily, we address Grand Masters as most worshipful. The word excellent is really found in the York Rite. Why should this be different? Hiram is presumably a Grand Master from the craft entire. is not accorded that title. And then the deeper question came to mind. What was there that was excellent about Solomon anyway? Why did the ritual develop in this way? First of all, we should remember that our ritual, as we have it, is of English origin. The word excellent is a honorific, just like excellency. And in such usage, we apply to royalty or nobility. Likewise, the word worshipful is applied to certain offices. In this sense, it is certainly correct to speak of most excellent King Solomon. Can we apply this to man himself? But before we make any judgment, it might be better to speculate on how ritual itself came to its present form. I use the word speculate because we really don't know the full story. There may have been several reasons why the eventual ritual of the Master Mason degree, indeed the teachings of all degrees, became centered around the lessons of the temple. The most obvious one is simply that the operative Masons were builders. It was not much of a stretch to see a link between the buildings of King Solomon's temple and the erection of the magnificent cathedrals. The operative Masons saw theirs as a holy calling, as did Solomon. Everywhere in England, indeed, also in Scotland and Ireland, there were the examples of building, the cathedrals, and the castles. And where better to look for building and the builders than in the stories about Solomon and the first temple in Jerusalem? A second thought about the development of the ritual, especially the second section of our third degree. How would this teaching of the fraternity be communicated? Obviously by lectures, or the one-on-one instruction of the apprentice by an older fellow of the craft. But lecturing, even this gets boring, and something more striking was needed. Beginning in the 1300s, there developed in both England and the continent of the community dramas known as the mystery, or the morality plays. In the research that I have done, the various guilds or workers' associations each took part, putting on different scenes, almost always of a religious nature. For example, the bankers' guilds at York and Coventry always did a playwright depicting the Last Supper. The plasterers did the creation. You would laugh to learn that the water carriers did the story of Noah and the flood, and the shipwrights the building of the ark. Yes, the Masons had a part, but it was not the building of the temple, rather the coming of the wise men in the Christmas story. There was, however, one play which had to do with the building of the temple. It was called Hiram's Dream. It depicted the vision which Hiram, the architect, had for the temple. Unfortunately, as the Protestant Reformation prevailed in England, and the plays were barred as being Catholic, that and many other manuscripts were lost or destroyed. Nonetheless, a century and a half later, that format of the mystery play found its way back in the legend of the third degree, the building of the temple, and the appearance of the one we address as most excellent, King Solomon. It may seem anticlimactic because this has been a long way back to the question, what was excellent about Solomon? Here I want to touch on some features of the king's life, trying to look at it with a historian's eye, but a Mason's heart. It is difficult not to be preachy because the most of what we know comes from the Holy Scriptures, especially in the first book of Kings with echoes and chronicles, the early historians Josephus and Eusebius, and some of the findings of modern archaeology. We should not forget that the temple was a historic fact, that Solomon, King Hiram of Tyre, and Hiram the skilled craftsman were actual historical figures. It would not be surprising if, across the nearly 3,000 years since they had lived, legends and myths did not develop. Indeed, they were the short of leaders about whom stories would cluster. Parenthetically, it should be noted that almost every culture has a story about a faithful workman who lost life in defense of its integrity. Small wonder that this found its way into the Masonic teachings. Nonetheless, it is fair to say that Solomon and his reign represented both heights and depths of ancient Israelite history. Here I am indebted to John Kenneth Kuntz, a younger ministerial colleague in Missouri, who went on a distinguished academic career as a professor of religion at the University of Iowa. First, Solomon left a record of administrative achievements. Ignoring traditional tribal boundaries, he recognized the nation into 12 administrative districts. These provisioned his court and served as a resource, and served as a source of labor for his building programs. Second, Solomon had a strong military policy. His military machine boasted 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen, 1 Kings 10:26. In modern terms, we might call it a quick strike force. He strengthened the fortifications of Jerusalem and put military centers and cavalry posts around the nation's perimeter. Again, Solomon pursued an active foreign policy much after the custom of the time. It was through marriage this was the custom of many nations even until modern times, except that it is the case of Solomon it seems to have been quite a harem. By marrying Pharaoh's daughter, Solomon secured the city of Gezer as part of her dowry. It served as a defensive outpost for Israel. Because of his alliance with Tyre, Solomon could expand his architectural and maritime ambitions. The nation had been primarily agrarian and pastoral. Solomon brought them into the world of commerce and industry. He established a trade program centered in the Gulf of Aqaba. He entered the caravan trade with the Sabian kingdom of Arabia through the visit of the Queen Sheba, 1 Kings 1 through 10 and 13. We have heard of horse traders. Solomon became a middleman in the business of chariots from Egypt and horses from Cilicia, all of which passed through the Israelite territory and presumably paid excise fees both ways. Then, of course, there was Solomon's building program, a full administrative complex, a house of Pharaoh's daughter, a judgment hall, and the house of the forest of Lebanon, which was both an armory and the treasury. And our Masonic ritual gives us embroidered biblical details of the temple, not alone a place of worship, but a symbol of imperial power. We may think of the three inner pillars, which are designated and explained in your second degrees. The final achievement of Solomon is that this was an age of enlightenment for ancient Israel. Open to the world of that day in material ways, it became culturally productive. Solomon fostered a court-centered wisdom movement. It is an exaggerated statement that Solomon spoke 3,000 proverbs and composed 1,005 songs, 1 Kings 4:31-32, and that the Hebrew scripture books of the Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and the Song of Solomon are attributed to him. Perhaps there is a Solomonic nucleus in the Proverbs. By all these criteria, the ancient king richly deserves the title of excellent. Yet we know that for all of his achievements, the reign of the power monarch sowed the seeds of the kingdom's failure. The grandiose programs drained the resources of the land. He had encouraged a social stratification which violated the Mosaic covenant, which embraced all Israelites as equal before God. He violated the Torah by his foreign marriages and his tolerance of alien faiths. Yet Solomon remains important for us as Freemasons. The lessons of the temple are not so much a narrative of history as they are an invitation of the kind of life we build and the faithfulness that we show. Finally, in the drama of the second section, Solomon keeps his word, but the real hero is not the king. Rather, it is you, the faithful Mason, who learns and lives those lessons. As the line from the song, "The Impossible Dream," goes, "And the world will be better for this." All right, so unfortunately, I will not be able to post these on the app for download. However, I will be hosting a file in its place for the app users, which you will find, I am sure. It will be a Masonic book that I know you will all like. If you do want copies of these texts that I have read, please contact the MSA, which is the Masonic Services Association of North America, via their website. They can be purchased for only a couple of dollars, and I believe a year subscription is only $12. So if you're wondering about the apps and what those are, they are apps for your phone or mobile device which let you listen to the show streaming, mark and download your favorites, and for supporting the show, I push out to the app users a free Masonic wallpaper each week as well as whatever paper I read. And in the rare cases that I cannot push the paper out, I will find something to fill the void that is equally as awesome or cool that always deals with Masonic subjects. Sometimes it's a book, sometimes it's another excerpt of a paper. But it's always good stuff. And there are a bunch of ways to support the show. That's just one of them. If you visit the newly redesigned website, wcypodcast.com, you'll see a tab at the top as well as a new slider which runs. And there's a slide in that slider that says support the show. Either one takes you to the same page, which is all about supporting the program. There are multiple options to support. The first, of course, we have an affiliate with Onnit Labs, which I'm sure that you've all heard about by now. I use many of their products, as do tons of my friends and colleagues, although they have several products. The one that I love more than anything, as do many others, is their flagship product called Alpha Brain. It's basically a vitamin. The type of vitamin is called a nootropic, which basically supercharges your focus and attention. It also gives you amazing dream states. It's really great stuff, and there is no caffeine. It's non-GMO. It's all natural and very healthy stuff. They don't even use any dyes in the capsules. So I like them so much that I signed up to be an affiliate. Basically, you click through our links on wcypodcast.com, located under the Support the Show tab, and you do some shopping. And no matter what you get, it's a great deal. We don't mark anything up for going through us. It's just when you click through, that's how they track who to give some kickback to. And because you're helping out the show, We help you out. If you use promo code WCY at the checkout, you get 10% off your order. It's a really great deal. There is, of course, another affiliate that we have as well, which is through my personal friend and brother, Juan Sepulveda, and his site, FreemasonryArt.com. If you guys click through or just go to FreemasonryArt.com, you can get some really amazing quality stuff from Brother Juan. It's all handmade, all made in the United States. I'm talking about real lambskin apron, brothers. Real deal, amazing works of art that you can wear to lodge. Also, Juan can even create custom artwork for your apron and paint it on using a technique that maximizes the life of the image no matter how many times you wear it, as long as you're taking care of it, of course. But seriously, you owe it to yourself to go check these aprons out and his art. And if you decide to buy something, you can, of course, get 10% off by using our promo code WCY. If none of those work for you, but you do indeed want to contribute to the show, we also accept PayPal donations, which are in the amount that you choose. I thank you all in advance for your help in keeping this show alive and rolling into the future. And before we wrap it up this week, I owe you all a famous Freemason segment. And this week is a double. Joseph Michael Montgolfier and Jacques Etienne Montgolfier, born respectively the 26th of August 1740 and his brother on the 6th of January 1745. Joseph passed away the 26th of June 1810 and Jacques passed away the 2nd of August 1799. They were the inventors of the Montgolfier style hot air balloon, aerostatique. The brothers succeeded in launching the first manned ascent carrying Etienne into the sky. Later in December 1783, in recognition of their achievements, their father, Pierre, was elevated to the nobility and the hereditary appellation of de Montgolfier by King Louis XVI of France. The brothers were born into a family of paper manufacturers in Annonay in Ardèche, France. Their parents were Pierre Montgolfier, 1700 to 1793, and his wife, Anne Duret, 1701 to 1760, who had 16 children. Pierre established his eldest son, Raymond Montgolfier, later Raymond de Montgolfier, 1730 to 1772, as his successor. So Joseph, the 12th child, possessed a typical inventor's temperament, a maverick and a dreamer, and impractical in terms of business and personal affairs. Etienne had a much more even and businesslike temperament as the 15th child, and particularly a troublesome one to his elder siblings. He was sent to Paris to train as an architect. However, after the sudden and unexpected death of Raymond in 1772, he was recalled to Annonay to run the family business. In the subsequent 10 years, Etienne applied his talent for technical innovation to the family business. Papermaking was a high-tech industry in the 18th century. He succeeded in incorporating the latest Dutch innovations of the day into the family mills. His work led to the recognition by the government of France, as well as the awarding of a government grant to establish Montgolfier factory as a model for other French papermakers. Of the two brothers, it was Joseph who first contemplated building machines as early as 1777 when he observed laundry drying over a fire incidentally form pockets that billowed upwards. Joseph made his first definitive experiment in November of 1782 while living in the city of Avignon. He reported some years later that he was watching a fire one evening while contemplating one of the great military issues of the day, an assault on the fortress of Gibraltar, which had proved impregnable for both sea and land. Joseph mused on the possibility of an air assault using troops lifted by the same force that was lifting the embers from the fire. He believed that contained within the smoke was a special gas, which he called Montgolfier gas, with a special property he called levity. On the 19th of September 1783, Aerostat Revelion was flown with the first living beings in a basket attached to a balloon, a sheep called Climb to the Sky, a duck, and a rooster. The sheep was believed to have a reasonable approximation of human physiology. The duck was expected to be unharmed by being lifted aloft. It was included as a control for effects created by the aircraft rather than the altitude. The rooster was included as further control as it was a bird that did not fly at high altitudes. The demonstration was performed before a crowd at the Royal Palace of Versailles, before King Louis XVI of France and Queen Marie Antoinette. The flight lasted approximately 8 minutes, covered 2 miles, and obtained an altitude of about 1,500 feet, or 460 meters. The craft landed safely after flying. With the successful demonstration at Versailles, and again in the collaboration with Revelion, Etienne started construction of a 60,000 cubic foot balloon for the purpose of making flights with humans. The balloon was about 75 feet tall and about 50 feet in diameter. It had rich decorative touches supplied by Revellion. The color scheme was gold, figures on a deep blue background, fleur-de-lis, signs of the zodiac, and suns with Louis XVI's face in the center interlaced with the royal monogram in the central section graced the majestic machine. Red and blue drapery and gold eagles were at the base of the balloon. It is fitting that Etienne Montgolfier was the first human to lift off the Earth, making at least one tethered flight from the yard of Revellion's workshop in the Faubourg Saint-Antoine. It was most likely on October 15, 1783. A little while later, at that same day, Pilat de Rozier became the second to ascend into the air to an altitude of 80 feet, which was the length of the tether. On the 21st of November, 1783, the first free flight by humans was made by Pilatre, together with an army officer, the Marquis de Arlans. The flight began from the grounds of the Chateau de la Muette in the western outskirts of Paris. They flew aloft about 3,000 feet above Paris for a distance of 9 kilometers. After 25 minutes, the machine landed between the windmills outside the city ramparts. Enough fuel remained on board at the end of the flight to have allowed a balloon to fly 4 or 5 times as far. However, burning embers from the fire were scorching the balloon fabric and had to be daubed out with sponges. As it appeared, it could destroy the balloon. Pilatre took off his coat to stop the fire. The Montgolfier Company still exists in Annonay or Ardèche, France. In 1799, Etienne de Montgolfier died. His son-in-law, Bartholomé Barreau de la Lombardière de Canson, succeeded him as the head of the company thanks to his marriage with Alexandrine de Montgolfier. The company became Montgolfier et Canson in 1801, then Canson Montgolfier in 1807. Nowadays, Canson still produces fine art papers, school drawing papers, and digital fine art and photography papers, and is sold in 120 countries. So, some really cool history there. My French is horrible. I only took 1 year of it in high school. I do have to apologize for my butchering of the French language. But that's it for this week. Please remember to find us on Facebook and follow on Twitter. Check out the new website design on www.wcypodcast.com. And please don't forget about the Midnight Freemasons, the Working Tools Magazine, the Masonic Roundtable, the Winding Stairs, Far From Centered, and all the rest. Support your Grand Lodge charities, and remember the Chicago Dyslexia Walk is coming up on the 31st of May. Please check that out and help us build a new center by donating or getting involved. Take care, everybody. Stay on the level. And for Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.